was nothing less than a battle between light and dark, the godly and the godless. And I do believe that that's how many of the participants in the insurrection viewed their actions, not as a political act, but as something taking place in a more timeless kind of cosmic spiritual framework.
Look, we only have about a minute or so left, but I wondered if you could go back before January 6th. In your book, you talk about the protest, the November 7th protest at the Pennsylvania State Capitol in Harrisburg, where you began to first realize that there could be violence. This was the Stop the Steal rally that occurred there. I'm wondering if you could talk about that and the fervor that drove some of these folks around the issue, the bogus issue that the election was stolen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was the day that all of the national news networks called the election for Biden, and you had a large gathering of Trump supporters, many of them belonging to the Pennsylvania 3%er militia, heavily armed, at the state capitol in Harrisburg. And the moment the election was called, they were already calling for violence, and not just them, by the way, but elected officials as well. Congressman Dan Mauser was there. Doug Mastriano was there. Other Trump campaign surrogates were there, and there was just no question that they were going to accept the results of the election. But it wasn't just November 7th. It went back to, you know, previous rallies, even before all of the results had come in various swing states, which I witnessed, for example, in Detroit on Election Day. There was a mob at the TCF Convention Center.
We have 10 seconds, Luke.
Yeah, so January 6th was not a surprise. It was foretold.
And of course, Mastriano is running for governor of Pennsylvania right now, the Republican candidate. Luke Mogelson, The New Yorker's award-winning war correspondent. His new book out this week is titled The Storm Is Here, An American Crucible. And that does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8 a.m. Next up, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
Regime. Yeah, all right. That's a good way to start off the show. Perhaps your morning, if you didn't listen to Democracy Now! And you're just tuning in to KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, Paul Rowe. And that's me. I'll be with you for the hour until 9 o'clock. Yes, and of course, that was the Sex Pistols. I kind of want to hear that just about every time I swing by one of the stations that's doing the interminable coverage of the death of the good Queen Elizabeth, which is rather, personally speaking, is rather disgusting just to see the wall-to-wall coverage. You know, we did supposedly fight a revolution to end the monarchy and all that. Anyway, so I don't know if you've read the lyrics. If you can make them out fairly well, but, you know, through the snarling and the spitting of Sid Vicious and Johnny Rotten, maybe hard. But the last lyrics we heard at the end there were, God save the Queen, because tourists are money, and our figurehead is not what she seems. Oh, God save history. God save your mad parade. Oh, Lord, God have mercy. All crimes are paid. When there's no future, how can there be sin? We're the flowers in the dustbin. We're the poison in your human machine. We're the future, your future. Anyway, it's good to see Democracy Now!, Amy and Juan, talking about the monarchy. I had a guest talking from Ireland, talking about the, you know, that there is a open discussion, I don't know how widely, I'm not there, of ending the monarchy after so many crimes through the centuries, so much suffering, so many deaths, so much theft and dispossession. And they've been talking a lot about that. They've been actually had quite a few people on the program over the past few days, week, from areas that were colonized by Britain and who suffered the consequences. So we'll see how that goes. I'm sure many of you have heard the story of the Sex Pistols renting a barge on the River Thames, floating down the River Thames on a barge, and blasting that song at full volume during the Queen's Silver Jubilee in 1977, 25 years on the throne. All right. Well, that's not what I wanted to talk about. Of course, you know, all this is really important, reckoning with history, which we do a lot on KBOO. I do a lot on this program, talking about, correcting the colonizers' history, the racist, misogynist history culture, this country has put in the history books until relatively recently, and acting upon that knowledge. But my view is, unless we do something much more incisive, we just ain't gonna act in time to deal with the other storm that's here. There's many storms that are here, and they're all intersecting, not in good ways at present. I'm talking about the storm of global heating. And that's a theme I've also dealt with over the years, the issue of not just climate change, but this really bedeviling issue of time, you know. Pull up my program page entitled Better Too Late Than Never, the two in parentheses. So over the past several decades, numerous target dates or time frames have been put forward as the point where we must start reducing or already have reduced fossil fuel emissions by X amount or face irreversible, possibly cataclysmic consequences. By the year 2000, by 2020, by 2030, by 2050, etc. And many of these target dates have, of course, come and gone. And those who propose them, I don't know, maybe they just shifted the target further into the future. Of course, putting it further into the future, like, say, 2050, makes it a little easier. You don't have to actually necessarily, certainly not immediately, reckon with you know, the possibility that you were completely off target from the begin with. Maybe it was by the year 2000. Maybe we are too late. Anyway, it's strangely similar to the way that, you know, apocalyptic cult leaders have proposed dates for the end of the world. But of course, in this case, we really are talking about the end of the world as we know it, and even the possible extinction of us, our species, and many other species on the Earth. It's, you know, it's hard to wrap our heads around. It's hard to think about, hard to talk about, hard maybe listen to. Maybe people have already turned this off. Maybe they've thought they've heard enough. But hopefully I will be presenting you some things that will make you think afresh. I mean, of course, if it is too late, well, then why talk about it at all, for crying out loud? You know, I always like the quote, you know, if a situation is or seems impossible, you've got to change the conditions that actually make it possible. You know, whether or not that is our case, whether that can happen, I don't know. No one actually knows. But if you take seriously the worst case scenarios, and I'm going to be playing a little part of a podcast in just a minute here by Guy McPherson, I'll hopefully convince you that the time frames are really, really short, and that the vastness of what we have unleashed with our industrial processes, the burning of fossil fuels and the emissions and the accumulation in our atmosphere, which leads to the so-called greenhouse effect, similar to a greenhouse, which traps the heat. That's the glass that traps the heat. In this case, the greenhouse gases act like a layer of glass and trap the heat, the solar radiation, and it just keeps building up and building up, and we keep setting records and records. You've seen them this summer. You saw them last summer. The storms are getting bigger. The droughts are getting more intense. The wildfires are raging. So, yeah, well, at least we can talk about it. All right, so as I said, I'm going to play this bit. Listen very carefully, please, to this thing, because that's what we're going to talk about. This Guy McPherson, who was a longtime academic, I think mostly at the University of Arizona, if I'm not mistaken. And he started coming out and talking about the possibility of rapid, talking about abrupt climate change, massive shifts on a much shorter time scale than anybody else was really talking about, or anybody with his, you know, level of getting, being able to get some public attention. And it hurt him. It hurt him a lot. It basically ruined his academic career, made him something of a pariah, but he plugs away and he talks about that. So we've got that coming up right now, if I can get Ty to play that.
American poet Henry Charles Bukowski is credited with the line, quote, "Find what you love and let it kill you," end quote. After extensive research conducted by other scholars, there remains no evidence Charles Bukowski ever wrote this line. I continue to follow this advice, regardless of who wrote or said it. I continue my longtime path as science educator, in the spirit of Carl Sagan, even recognizing that doing so has destroyed my public life. I have found what I love, and it's killing me. What do I love? Teaching, of course. Specifically, I love following the singular path of science education. I love collating and summarizing the evidence underlying abrupt, irreversible climate change. Obviously, I do not love the conclusion that points to our near-term demise. Regardless of the outcome, however, I have assumed the role of science educator because I can't seem to help myself. Teaching is not merely what I do. A teacher is who I am. Among the many contributors to abrupt, irreversible climate change I have been pointing out for more than a decade is atmospheric methane. I have been criticized by Michael Mann and other so-called climate scientists who claim that the abrupt release of methane could not possibly lead to rapid planetary warming. Let's turn to the evidence. First, though, I'll mention that I receive a lot of criticism for not doing primary research, as I did for two decades. Because I have limited access to university infrastructure, I conduct secondary research, relying on the primary research conducted by other scholars to reach my own conclusions. It's a lot like the McPherson paradox. I'm damned if I do, and damned if I don't. And now, back to the evidence discovered by other scholars. A peer-reviewed paper published in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences on August 22, 2022, has revealed a massive destabilization of methane hydrates in the maximum warning phase of the Eemian period, 125,000 to 126,000 years ago, titled Evidence for Massive Methane Hydrate Destabilization During the Penultimate Interglacial Warming. The significance portion of the paper points to, quote, strong evidence of methane release and oxidation, almost certainly due to massive methane hydrate destabilization during the early part of the penultimate warm episode, 126,000 to 125,000 years ago. End quote. The abstract reports, quote, we focused on the early part of the penultimate interglacial and present a hitherto undocumented and remarkably large intermediate water warming of 6.8 degrees C in response to a brief episode of meltwater-induced modest Atlantic meridional overturning circulation weakening centered at 126,000 to 125,000 years ago, end quote. Most people watching this video are familiar with the Gulf Stream, which is the surface part of the AMOC in the North Atlantic. Again, I turn to the abstract. Quote, the warming of intermediate waters to 14 degrees C significantly exceeds the stability field of methane hydrates, end quote. The abstract concludes with that the warming, quote, was almost certainly the result of massive destabilization of methane hydrates. This study documents and connects a sequence of climatic events and climatic feedback processes associated with and triggered by the penultimate climate warming that can serve as a paleoanalog for modern ongoing warming. End quote. Yes, it certainly, quote, can serve as a paleoanalog for modern ongoing warming. End quote. Release of abundant methane into the atmosphere happened in the past. It can happen today. Indeed, it seems such a release is already underway. Additional context is probably needed. According to a peer-reviewed paper by James Hansen and 14 other colleagues, published in Earth System Dynamics on July 18, 2017, Earth is at its highest temperature since the Eemian, meaning the highest temperature with any civilization present. I can assure you that the global temperature has not cooled during the last 5 years. This paper, published late last month in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, indicates the means by which methane can be released rapidly into the atmosphere, with rapid planetary heating to follow. In other words, people claiming that the so-called methane bomb cannot be triggered are incorrect. These people include, of course, Michael Mann and other people claiming to be knowledgeable about climate change. Here's a little more context. Current Siberian heating is unprecedented during the last 7 millennia. This, according to a peer-reviewed paper in Nature Communications, published on August 25, 2022, written by Rashid Hantemirov and 11 other scholars, the paper's abstract includes these lines, quote, we demonstrate that the recent anthropogenic warming interrupted a multi-millennial cooling trend. We find the industrial era warming to be unprecedented in rate and to have elevated the summer temperature to levels above those reconstructed for the past 7 millennia in both 30-year mean and the frequency of extreme summers. This is undoubtedly of concern for the natural and human systems that are being impacted by climatic changes that lie outside the envelope of natural climatic variations for this region, end quote. Let me repeat that last sentence. Quote, this is undoubtedly of concern for the natural and human systems that are being impacted by climatic changes that lie outside the envelope of natural climatic variations for this region, end quote. You think? Despite raising the issue of concern, this recent paper in Nature Communications fails to cite earlier relevant work. Specifically, an important paper published on February 10, 2009 in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences was somehow missed by the 12 authors of this paper in Nature Communications. The paper published in February 2009, written by Susan Solomon and colleagues, is titled Irreversible Climate Change Due to Carbon Dioxide Emissions. It includes this information in the abstract. Quote, this paper shows that the climate change that takes place due to increases in carbon dioxide concentration is largely irreversible for 1,000 years after emissions stop. Following cessation of emissions, removal of atmospheric carbon dioxide decreases radiative forcing, but is largely compensated by slower loss of heat to the ocean, so that atmospheric temperatures do not drop significantly for at least 1,000 years. End quote. In other words, we have known for more than a decade, based on the conservative peer-reviewed literature, that climate change is irreversible for at least the next 1,000 years. Based on recent papers in prestigious and conservative peer-reviewed journals, we know that methane can rapidly warm Earth, and that it already has. We know that maintenance of civilization depends upon maintaining the relatively cool planetary temperature necessary to grow, store, and distribute grains at a large scale. We know that a reduction in industrial activity leads to rapid planetary heating. We also know that such a rapid rate of environmental change will cause Earth to lose habitat for humans and most, if not all, other life. Please remember that I am quoting the work of other scholars. And also, please remember that I am criticized for not doing my own primary research. No, really. I couldn't make up this nonsense. That's nonsense, spelled S. I've pointed out the cost of lies earlier in this space. I've also quoted from John Kenneth Galbraith's 1977 book, The Age of Uncertainty. Quote, people of destruction rather than surrender any material part of their advantage, end quote. It seems we are paying the ultimate cost for the lies told during the last century. Maybe it's been longer. Let's not stress about the details. Please like, subscribe, and share this video. Click the bell when you subscribe so you'll be notified about future videos. Become a member of this channel for additional perks at as little as 99 cents per month. Mostly, though.
Okay, and that was Guy McPherson from his Nature Bats Last podcast. And I linked to that on my program page, Wednesday Talk Radio. Today's show, Better, in parentheses, Too Late Than Never, question mark. And you can find that. And then there's actually another video, I forgot to mention that. That's from Inside Climate News, which is the source of the graphic for today. Are we too late? Question mark. And the video, referring back to my my talking about the target dates that have been set by, any number of scientific, activist, organizational, political figures, target dates by which we need to act or it's too late. In that video, in fact, he says, they say clearly, it's a short video worth watching, that we need to peak our emissions at by 2020 and then rapidly decrease them thereafter. Of course, we have passed the year 2020. So what does that all mean? I did want to point out, I think we're dealing with an expletive that he spelled out, and I believe you can't do that, which was a synonym for nonsense. Let's just leave it there. And afterwards, there's a quote you may have missed, and I forget who gave the quote, that basically people who can't give up their privileges or their material goods, they would rather... they'd rather be doomed. They'd rather be, face destruction or doom than give up. And I think that's more true for most of us than we'd probably like to admit. Because essentially, if you really take this stuff seriously, and I know it's hard to do, folks, I kind of force myself to, because I deal with it on this radio show quite a bit, and so I'm forced to read stuff and interview people, and a lot of people might not come across in your day-to-day lives, which is understandable, which is hopefully why some of you listen to shows like this on KBOO, and why you support KBOO, as an aside, by the way, kboo.fm, click on donate. we do need your support. People, you know, basically it implies, you know, I got to the conclusion that really the key to me, the key is demilitarization, because the military is basically the spearhead of technological innovation, of growth of civilizations, of colonization, the rise of capitalism, the need for all this weaponry and the machinery of war, which then gets sort of trickles down to the rest of society, becomes machines for everybody, first in the hands of the royalty, and then, you know, when the royalty is overthrown, the oligarchs who take their place, etc. And the military uses the lion's share now of these fossil fuels, creates the lion's share of emissions. I'm talking about in terms of individual institutions. And the military prevents us from solving the crisis because we keep going to wars, and we keep having tensions and conflicts that prevent us from having the kind of global nation state framework of discussion to actually demilitarize, to, and not just demilitarize, you know, to decarbonize. Decolonize, demilitarize, decarbonize is now a slogan of some of the more cutting edge activists on these issues. But the military prevents it. The interests of the military industrial complexes around the world prevents us from getting anywhere. So, you know, we've put off dealing with that because, you know, feed the military and maybe we can solve some of our long simmering domestic crises, the festering racism, festering sexism. We can incrementally, you know, pass the legislation necessary, but we never really touch the military. We never really touch the American empire. And it's time now, folks. It's way past time. So yeah, I think people can't admit, people can't face the vastness of this, for one thing. In general, I'm speaking in general, I'm not speaking to you as an individual, but if it does apply to you, you know, take it seriously. And we can't admit that, you know, our entire way of life is implicated. You know, the military-industrial complex has continually, you know, gotten us out of the economic quagmires, depressions, recessions. No, we got to just keep on feeding the military, keep on pumping out the armaments, keep people employed, and keep toxifying everybody who lives near the bases, and keep allowing, you know, the United States and others to run rampant over the less militarized people of the world. So yeah, I think we don't really want to admit that our entire way of life is implicated. That has to change, or we're doomed. Frankly, I think frankly most people, mostly unconsciously, would perhaps rather be doomed than to actually do what it takes to change. You know, I know it's easy to say these things over the radio. I know I don't do what I could do even. But you know, we're all fragmented, atomized, individualized. Now we've got, you know, then we've got COVID. We had Trump. We've got this. We've got that. It's a dismal situation. I'm just speaking, trying to speak factually from what the physics and chemistry is telling us that's going on, and that either we confront it somehow, we find the wherewithal, or I believe with Guy McPherson. So let's just go after what he says. So he says that there's this methane bomb. You've heard this over the years if you're a longtime KBU listener. I haven't talked about it that much recently. I don't know about other programs. But I know Teresa Mitchell used to talk about it a lot. Several years ago, I talked about it more. And it's kind of hard just to keep on going. It's heavy duty. But I think now there's actually more, as Guy McPherson is citing, there's actually more accumulation of evidence that's allowing even the... that's making it difficult even for the climate scientists, he cites Michael Mann, who's not the only one, who aren't as willing to look at these more extreme worst case scenarios, right? So basically, okay, the methane bomb, there's the what they call methane clathrates, which are frozen methane on the bottom of oceans, seas. The biggest one apparently is on the East Siberian Arctic shelf off of the coast of Russia, coast of Siberia. But there's others all over the globe. And the theory, and this you know, there's been scientific research on this. The science says that methane emissions have been increasing fairly dramatically over the past few years. So yeah, Guy McPherson and others say that it's actually happening. So what do they use as evidence? Yeah, they use as evidence what's happening right now. Methane increases. A theoretical construct for, you know, the possibility, you know, the heating up of the oceans, that heating up going further down to the depths where, you know, the reason why the East Siberian Arctic Shelf is so dangerous is because it's relatively shallow compared to some of the others, which are, you know, it may be 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 feet. I don't know what the depth exactly is, but it's relatively shallow, which is why people are more worried about that. Okay, so they talk, there's a model to explain how this can happen. And then the big piece is the paleoclimatic evidence, which he talked about. He talked about all these things. He talked about the papers that have come out and relatively recently, last year and this year, talking about the evidence for a massive eruption of methane about between 126 and 125,000 years ago and the consequences of that. So that's what I want to put out there. And I want to talk to you about that. And I'd really like to stay on this topic, the issue of how much time do we really have? And, you know, what would it really take, you know, to actually reverse this? Is it even possible? I don't know. Are we too late? 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. That is the number to call. It looks like we already have a caller, possibly. Go ahead, Lee. You're on.
Yeah, I wanted to call. You know, over the last three programs that you did, but you know, what I'm going to say, you know, most people don't want to hear. But from my perspective, when you look at the federal budget, the military is, United States of America's solution to global warming. We are going to take by force what we need to survive. And when I say we, it ain't we the people, it's we the oligarchs.
They've been doing it for a long time.
They've been doing it for a long time, and they're going to keep doing it. And when you compare the military budget to the money spent on environmental mitigation, there isn't any comparison whatsoever.
That was let me just interrupt you briefly, and then you can continue. That was the other piece I neglected to say of the contribution of the military. It's that they take up so much of all the resources that there's none to actually deal with the real problems that we have.
And you know, who's gonna fight them? How are we going to stop them? The only thing that I can think of is a general strike worldwide that just stops everything. And I don't think people are ready to do that and make the necessary sacrifices. I think that it's not a happy opinion I have. I don't know what else to say about it.
Well,
let me just
push back gently on that. As you know, as an activist, as someone who's seen, you know, popular struggles arise, come and go, there are some precedents. You know, if you look at the GI resistance during the Vietnam War, obviously it's a totally different situation now, but they actually had a huge impact on the ability of the U.S. to keep fighting that war. You know, I'm not saying I'm not a GI, I'm not a veteran, I don't have access to them. I know that Veterans for Peace just did the first action that I know of, criticizing the U.S. military, and a bunch of people got arrested. So there's little, you know, and I'm not saying that's ever going to amount to enough, but, you know, we don't, you know, you can't just build a mass movement out of nothing. And then, you know, there has been resistance to various, shipping various military equipment to wars, nuclear missiles, nuclear submarines. There's been resistance to that. Right here, we've got a huge concentration of military in the Pacific Northwest. You know, what would happen if, you know, the relatively small but you know, vital activist formations, climate activists, anti-racist, you know, there's very little of an anti-imperialist movement. Maybe that could grow. Peace movement, you know, could start focusing on those military bases here in the Pacific Northwest. Where would that lead? And then I could go on. There's been others. Look at say, okay, the Black Lives Matter movement. No one was talking about defund the police before they started getting down in the streets and actually talking about and, you know, advancing well thought out proposals that, you know, that then got twisted, and there's been a massive pushback by the right wing. It's become, I think, fairly unpopular, you know, in terms of the general public, because, you know, the usual reasons. They out finance us. They have a greater presence in the mass media, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, defund the military hasn't really been talked about much. Maybe if people start talking about it, that's all I can think of. I can just think of, you know, concrete steps that could actually lead to, you know, I've seen movements get really big, really fast, and who knows? But anyway,
well,
that's all.
That's possible, but you know, what you did say is you know, mass media, and as long as it's corporate controlled, how well will any information
be
disseminated?
But I'm trying to focus on what are some possible things. And so how do you break in, you know, like the forest protection movement? No one was talking, I'm talking about back in the 80s. Hardly anyone knew that there are these incredibly beautiful, complex ancient forest ecosystems that were had been being slaughtered for decades. And we're continued to be slaughtered, then there's very little of them left. So people started sitting in trees and blocking logging roads, and, you know, the media did start covering it. So sometimes it takes, you know, a little more boldness and a little more creativity. I'm not saying anything's guaranteed as success. I'm just saying, you know, we have no control directly over the military, over the mass media. So we have to use the tools that we have. That's all I'm saying.
And what I'm saying is that will probably occur when situations become untenable and people begin to revolt.
Right on.
And that's the other issue is what type of planning do we have for replacements?
Replacements of what?
The current system.
Oh,
and if we don't have a replacement system. How are we going to control the powers that be?
Well, I think the replacement system is a functioning, more grassroots democracy. And so ending the most abusive, most distorting elements, which is the oligarchic control of the political system, all the movements to curtail. I mean, I think the oligarchs are really afraid of this big demographic shift that's been a long time in the making. And they fear that they could actually lose power if the democratic system actually was working. And, you know, there's signs that could happen if, you know, if we actually made it work, and there are a lot of people who've been working really hard to make it work, you know, mostly Black and Brown and women, and like, you know, Stacey Abrams, and, you know, there's been people in the trenches for a long time just trying to hold on to the gains that were made. And so, yeah, if people actually vote, the majority sentiments were actually of the country at this point in time were reflected in the electoral process, we would actually have some major shifts, you know, which would be a start towards creating a much bigger change. Anyway, we do have another caller. Lee, it was really good talking to you. If Chuck is still patiently waiting, let's go to Chuck.
Good morning. Professor Peterson was talking about that the man-made global warming policies will be used as an excuse to starve to death a billion people within the next 2 years.
What the heck? Who's this Professor Peterson?
He is a professor out of Canada. And what the imperialists are doing, they're playing both sides.
So how are they going to, so people are starving right now. I mean, there's droughts, there's massive amounts of, so they're going to, I don't understand, how's that going to work?
They're using the man-made global warming policies to take people's farms around the globe.
Really? You know, give me a specific example.
What happened in Sri Lanka? That's a result of man-made global warming policies.
So which policies specifically you're talking about?
I'm not privy to the details.
Oh, well, come on. If you don't even know what policies, then you're just blowing smoke. You're just blowing smoke if you don't actually know what policies.
Well, you listen, I am focusing on the imperialists, what they're doing.
No, I disagree. I think the imperialists are doing something completely different. But if you don't have an example of what this Professor Peterson is supposedly saying, that man may...
You're the one who will not... who closes your mind to
reality. No, I'm not. I'm asking you to tell me what policies, because that's the crux of the matter. If you say that the imperialists are using...
They're taking people's... Have you heard about the Dutch farmers who are protesting in Holland?
Yeah, and specifically about what now?
About global warming policies. They're taking their farms.
Okay, which global warming policies are you talking about? If you don't even know that, then you...
The taxes that run them out of business.
The taxes that run them out of business. Well,
CO2 taxes that run them out of business.
That's why...
They're running farmers out of business all over the globe. And a billion people...
It's mass industrial agriculture that has been destroying small family farms around the globe for 100 years or more. That's what's doing. The small family farmer has been under the gun of the industrial agricultural system. That's what's done to the oligarchs of the industrial agricultural system. I'm afraid you don't know what you're talking about.
I understand that. Do you know why the oligarchs have that power?
Because they've got the guns and they've got the political process on their side.
We gave them the power when we decided to abandon federalism.
Oh, okay. Listen, man, we got other callers. I just don't have time for this.
Hold on, one second. Let me say one other thing.
Okay, go ahead. One other thing. Go ahead.
Progressive left economic policy is being used to wage genocide on blacks in America.
All right, that's your last word. Go ahead. Okay, all right. Well, I guess it's a good thing that some of those people are actually listening to this show. You know, I don't know. Progressive, I mean, I have a lot of criticisms of the progressive left. Don't even get me started on that. But, you know, the progressive left is the only bulwark for any kind of social change against the vicious racist system, which is the legacy of slavery and genocide and the rest, the real genocide. All right, don't get me started. Okay, so let's see who we got next. We got all men calling. That's okay. Oh no, we got Liz next. I'm sorry, I saw Steve. Go ahead, Liz. You're on deck. You're on the air.
Hello, Emma. Can you hear me?
Uh huh. Yes.
Okay. Thank you for the topic, and I would like to address your original topic. I love defund the military, and I just have one comment that the American military emits more carbon than any other country in the world, including our own. And that's right from Democracy Now. And that's all I have to say.
Okay. Thank you, Liz. I'm actually not sure that's strictly accurate. I believe we were like, I don't know, some number. If we were a country, it would be, I don't know, number 8 or 15 or something, or 5, or I don't think that's actually strictly accurate, but I'll have to check on that. But yeah, we are, the U.S. military is the biggest institutional user of fossil fuels and the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases on the planet as a single institution. And I don't think it anywhere near equals the total greenhouse gas emissions of the rest of the United States. But anyway, I could be wrong, but okay, we got all sorts of callers. Apparently this topic has sparked interest, which is good. Maybe people want to address the imminent threat of the release of methane, which has been, basically methane has been largely left out of the big global processes for dealing with climate change. I'm talking about the intergovernmental panel on climate change, which is, you know, the only real place where internationally this has been being addressed. But it's a really a low level, you look at it, it's a really low level a framework or process. There's a better word I'm thinking of, but anyway, that for deal with it, you know, you have, you know, relatively lower level government officials. You know, you maybe have presidents making a cameo appearance, or a vice president here and there. Not even that, you know, maybe a cabinet secretary, but you know, it needs to be a much higher level. I mean, this is, if indeed this is like a comet heading towards us, you know, don't look up. I'm sure many of you have seen that. The metaphor of climate change is a comet, to basically get people, to kind of rattle people's cages a little more to get the urgency of the situation. If it's coming at us as fast as Guy McPherson was talking about, then anyway, that's the issue that I'm trying to talk about, the time frame that we are on. And what is even possible within that time frame? Everything else is just noise, really. It's like we can talk about anything we want. We can talk about alternative fuels. We can talk about this Green New Deal. But if it doesn't get at the time frame that the geophysical processes are at which the geophysical processes are actually occurring, it doesn't mean nothing. So anyway, let's go to Steve. You're up next.
Am I on?
Yeah, you're on.
Okay, I just got a quick comment. I got to get back to work here, but the whole problem with, and I wish you'd do a show on this, is inequality. I don't think we're going to solve any of these problems, whether it's global warming or you know, wars or whatever. If we don't address extreme inequality, which is behind all of this,
well, but it's all the same. It's all the same thing. So we're talking about an oligarchy. We're talking about an oligarchy, which is what creates a capitalist system,
right,
with an oligarchy in charge. That is what sustains and creates the inequality. So how do we deal with them? It's the same problem.
All these peripheral problems that come from this all relate back to extreme inequality.
Right, but I'm saying
we had hunter gatherers and we had equality, we didn't have these problems.
But I'm saying we have a geophysical problem, that we have this possibility that these methane clathrates, these
guess
methane
what,
that's stored.
The greedy aren't going to let you solve that.
Well, I agree. So how do we? So then, okay. So how do we do it then? Give me a solution. How do we jumpstart a mass movement that's going to overthrow the oligarchy and institute a real democracy that's going to redirect, and the military industrial complex is going to redirect resources to all the Go ahead.
I think programs like KABU should focus on some of the reality that that it, focus on the fact that it is inequality, and then two, you need to define what socialism is, because all humans are socialistic. We are the most socialistic animal on the planet, and the reason we made advances because we're socialistic. And the most socialistic people, believe it or not, are the wealthy class. The reason, but they take advantage of the socialistic system. In other words, nobody makes their own extreme wealth. They have to, you know, take advantage of the social system, that the constructs that we have in place that the working class produces for them. So we have to define the true reality of socialistic socialism, and that is that we, in other words, if we were an anti-socialistic society, or, well, there's no such thing as society without socialism, we would be like black bears or something. We would never get together and cooperate. We would never work for anybody else. There would be no such thing as war or anything either, because without socialism, the cooperation of each other, you would never have war. So we have to be socialistic.
It's kind of too late in the hour, I think, to get as deep into it as it really needs to really parse out what you're saying.
Maybe you should have a show on what true socialistic concept is instead of this.
Well, it may not be what your socialistic concept is.
It is. Well, eliminate all the money and all the modern construct, and we are socialistic. We exchange more than any other animal in the world. That's reality.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, we are social beings, but when you say socialistic, that's kind of a political concept, and which is further down the line
it shouldn't be.
Anyway, all I got to say is the reality is nothing happens without struggle, and I've seen people struggle, and I've seen people succeed. I've seen people half succeed. I've seen people fail. We are in the biggest fight
of
our lives.
You want to do away with inequality, and if we don't focus on that, we'll never accomplish anything.
Okay. Well, fine. Everybody's got their pet way of looking at framing the issue.
It's not a pet wave, it's reality. It's reality. Inequality forces all of things from war to you name it. It's all based on...
No, come on. Okay, listen. So what was the origin? Then you have to get into the actual origins of inequality and the idea that we were always like this. Hold on.
State and farming.
Well, yeah, that's
when we were hunter gatherers, we did not have extreme inequality. We didn't.
Well, we didn't have extreme inequality, but you know, there's evidence actually that hunter gatherers actually established some of the first temples, which is some arguably at Göbekli Tepe, which is arguably I think is the origin point of this whole, you know, central organized, you know, warfare grew out of centralized organization. And there's evidence that it was actually hunter-gatherers that established the temples at Göbekli Tepe.
Inequality, the city state.
Right. Everything. Well, come on. Inequality, equality. There's ranked hierarchy in just about every species in different forms, including all primates. You know. Okay. So bonobos had particular strategies for dealing with, you know, the tensions resulting from sexual conflict and hierarchy. You know, we are not exactly bonobos. We share some traits with bonobos, some traits with chimpanzees. You know, but the human...
Okay, then I guess we should just accept inequality and the...
No, I'm just saying that it's... The dealing with inequality is a social process. Inequality arises from a social process. You know, is it helpful to...
Some people unfair share of the rest, and then they make greedy decisions.
Right, and that was...
Send people to war to chop each other up for no reason whatsoever.
It's true. Of course we have to deal with that, but the problem is we have to deal with all the things that have been, all the social realities that have been put in place in the, you know, in the past 10, 20, 100, 200, 500
the
years.
The root of it all is inequality. The root of it all is...
Okay, well, we got other callers. We got other callers, but thank you for calling and you know, sure. But, you know, but what's, how do we actually do it is, I guess, the main question. So let's go to our next caller, which is Mark, if you're still...
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. According to my understanding, the United States was the first, or was a great leader in welfare state understanding with FDR and with the minimum wage and with Social Security. And now, of course, we're living in a strange time where the right wing has advanced or is trashing basic welfare state understandings. Now, I'd like to talk about the rivers and the oceans. I think the first need that we have is for a Marshall Plan for journalism, because I think the concentration of wealth has narrowed the dialogue, the debate. People don't have an understanding at all. I read a little blurb from Austria saying that they can't get media attention to their protests. Now, the drought is so severe that 75% of these rivers, the Danube, the Rhine River, the Chuchang, the main river in China, have disappeared. So my question is, what is the reality? Are we living in a state of a climate emergency?
Yes, exactly.
Where the future is just prepared for us by Barron's. Barron's had an article about maybe the Germans aren't suffering so much. Now, what do you do when 75% of the Rhine is gone? Doesn't the economy, the society stop?
Well, it takes, you know, these things are basically unprecedented in our time.
Yes.
You know, they happen in times when we had major climatic disturbances like we're undergoing now. You know, that's the precedent for what's going on. We didn't have highly developed, highly mechanized, highly centralized social systems, technological systems like we do now. And, you know, there are certain events that would break those down very rapidly. I mean, look what's happening in Pakistan. The only reason, you know, Pakistan's able to deal with what they're dealing with right now, you know, is ultimately because they can, they have some form of centralized control is vulnerable, but it also has the capability of redeploying resources. So yeah, they can ship, you know, massive quantities of tents. I mean, have you seen where, you know, some of those refugee camps where they just ship thousands and thousands of big tents and then automatically, you know, or earthquake areas or after hurricanes, you know.
And they're shifting rivers, aren't they?
Right. Wait, let me just finish my point. So yeah, so a centralized state has certain capabilities to respond to these things, but at a certain point they could just be totally overwhelmed, and then, you know, then you have large scale societal breakdown, which people have been predicting. A wildfire on the scale of, you know, what's happened in 2 years ago here in Oregon or what's happened in California, that's a cataclysm to certain communities, you know. But say you had like 10 of those mega fires in one state at the same time, or, you know, you had, you know, a bunch of those mega fires plus a massive hurricane plus, you know, the insurance industry is only able, and the federal government through FEMA is only able to, you know, we're ultimately, you know, we can print money, we can deploy resources, but at a certain point, you know, there's going to be a contradiction between what the earth is throwing at us and our ability to respond.
There's a great website, steadystate.com, I think, or it might be .org, but they have a study on immigration. I'm so sick of these important issues just being trivialized by the donor class, and so we're not dealing with the climate, we're not dealing with drought, we're not dealing with immigration.
Right, so we have to create we have to jumpstart a mass movement that is doing what's never been done before, which is to overthrow the oligarchy in a way that can create the kind of, grassroots controlled, democratic system that's able to, you know, defund the military, redeploy resources. Yeah, we got to do all that. We got to fight the
a Marshall Plan by
right, but we got it. We got it.
Not by the government.
Right.
A Marshall Plan for journalism.
Well, okay, that's a good idea. Well, on that note, we have to get out of here. Mark, thanks for calling. Sorry, Robbie, we are out of time. Yeah, well, that's been an interesting conversation. We've sort of stayed on topic, which is good. So, yeah, Go to my program page, look at some of the links there. That's the Wednesday Talk Radio, KBOO.FM. Support us. That's your small Marshall Plan for journalism is, you know, that's all I can say. I think KBOO does a decent job with what we got, and we need to keep it going. All right. Thanks, Ty, for running the board. I'm out of here.